Hello, everybody, and welcome to Transmission. It's me, Quentin, and this week we've got Nicholas from InGrid Capacity, and we're going to talk all about the Nordics. Now, we haven't covered the Nordics in great detail on this podcast before, and this company, or Nicholas and the company, have moved so quickly. So this is a company to watch. They've got hundreds of megawatts already built in Sweden, and they're making big moves in Finland and elsewhere. And I think what's unusual is a lot of investors in Europe have been thinking about the Nordics, but haven't yet passed investment decisions. And InGrid have really gone for it. Nicholas really knows his stuff. He's a power markets guy, and I know you're going to like this conversation. And while you're listening, if you enjoyed this conversation, please hit like, subscribe, or comment. It means we can increase our reach, and we can have a much bigger impact with all the stuff that we do. Now let's jump in. Nicholas, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Pleasure being here.
So InGrid Capacity, let's start with the name. Who's InGrid?
InGrid represent, for us it's a Swedish name. We're building a Swedish company in Europe, but it's also like in InGrid. It's a play with words. So that's the background of the name.
And what I'm really excited about this conversation for, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners are going to get a lot from this, is there's loads of development activity across Europe right now, especially in the UK, in Germany, Italy, Iberia. But there's not that many folks really going hard at the Nordics. And InGrid Capacity is one of the very few companies that has achieved scale. And I take my hat off to you. You've gone so quickly from founding only a few years ago to where you are right now. Could you just share some data or some numbers around your operational assets in the Nordics? Because I think for some of our listeners, this will be extremely surprising how much scale there already is in the Nordics.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have, as of today, we have 212 megawatts under management in batteries in the Nordics. We have another roughly 200 megawatts under construction today. We're building our third asset portfolio in Finland of 70 megawatts, 140 megawatt hours. And we raised, as to this day, roughly 250 million euros in assets in the Nordic grid.
And please, if I may, what did you see in the Nordic market that 90% of other European investors missed?
I think that the first thing, of course, if you look at the Nordic system, it's hydro-based. And somewhere 2021, 2022, you could actually start with the drop in BESS prices, you could actually start to outcompete the hydro. And I think that was kind of an aspect that no one really saw coming. But we did the numbers and we looked at, you know, what's the revenue is going to look like, and it looked pretty interesting. And then with the following development of BESS prices, that's been a huge change in the system. And I think today much of the ancillary service markets is actually covered by batteries in the Nordic.
And you've got some pretty lofty targets you're aiming for. I think you said 8 gigawatts under management by the end of this decade. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. And that's the kind of North Star that we're aiming for as a company.
And before we talk about the different markets, and we're going to get really deep on those, a bit more about the company. So you've scaled headcount really quickly. You've scaled megawatts under management. You've raised 250 million euros. Could you just talk a little bit about the last few years from founding, I think in 2021 or 2022, to where you are right now? I know scaling a business is extremely difficult to do and hold on to culture and making sure the talent bar is high and making sure the wheels don't fall off on the way. We haven't even got as fast as you have. So what's that been like?
I mean, it's been a bumpy ride, I must say, but it's also been a hugely, you know, challenging and developing ride. I think that we're trying to build a fully integrated vehicle here. We're developing best assets and best projects, but we're also doing the trading on our assets. We're doing the commercial structuring of our assets, and we're not only a developer with 65 people. We are much more than that, and we have kind of seen the value of having this full integration and getting the feedback loops from doing more parts of the value chain quite early on. So that's been, of course, one of the reasons, but it's been a ride, yeah.
Just from afar, massive kudos to you, and I'm really excited about where you can take this business. Let's talk about Sweden for a second. You're, of course, in Stockholm at the moment. You've got a couple of hundred megawatts in Sweden, and I know you've committed another 400 megawatts, is it, to SE3 and SE4 in Sweden. So can you just share an overview of the Swedish, maybe the whole electricity market in Sweden, and then where batteries fit in, and then where Ingrid fits in?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, might start at the point where SE4 in Sweden, the southern part of Sweden, is probably the most imbalanced electricity region in Europe. And I think most of our assets in Sweden is focused on SE3 or SE4 by that reason. The portfolio we have built and the portfolio we're building now has been really focused on speed to market. It's usually smaller systems with more ancillary service design to it. Looking a bit ahead, what we're going to do in Sweden, we're going to do bigger projects, scale it with more, you know, arbitrage intraday structured on the revenue side. And that will probably, I mean, we see these imbalances in the market. We see the market opportunity to scale it. But I think we passed the first phase of the BESS development cycle where, you know, you can make a lot of money on ancillary service markets. And that's super interesting from the start. Now we're coming into probably the next phase where ancillary is getting more saturated, the revenues are more stabilized. The more energy intensive structures is becoming the lead star for the revenues of the future.
Niklas, a few minutes ago you said something that I thought was really interesting, was that you framed your battery assets around competing with hydro. I think we should talk about that a little bit. How do you think about that? They are very different asset classes, right? Because batteries are shorter duration and hydro much, much longer. The Nordic regions have got tons of hydro. So how are you thinking about your assets coming up against hydro?
Well, I think the Nordics are blessed with the amount of hydro that we're having, and it's kind of the core fundamentals of why we actually had a low, stable electricity price for a very long time. What I do believe now is we're seeing a situation where shorter services, like ancillary service markets and everything within the hour, that's probably more, or it is actually much more efficient to solve that with batteries. That makes the hydro be able to run more optimal on their optimization curves. And it's also, you know, it saves a bit of hydro for the more longer periods of volatility and wherever it's not a wind. When we were out of the wind in the northern part of Sweden. And so I think what we're doing is we're making the hydro production to be more efficient and work more on balancing the long-term volatility in the system.
Just coming back to your assets in Sweden then, so are they predominantly in ancillary services right now?
Yes, as of now, I mean, we built our assets fully merchant, so we're all of the time steering it towards the most attractive part of the market. Still, we see a lot of opportunities in ancillary service markets or for assets online and being under construction, but long term, we will probably see a more diverse revenue stream where you have a bit of, you know, typical arbitrage wholesale structures, but you also see partly ancillary service and combination of different services. Also, a bit of, you know, we work a lot with local capacity as well to make sure that the DSO has the capacity they need to run the system and to increase the utilization rate of the existing infrastructure. That is a super important revenue stream that we see.
So coming back to the Nordics then. You obviously have a large footprint in Sweden. Is it the largest? Are you the biggest operator in Sweden?
I think on an asset base, we're absolutely the largest, yes.
And you've just made a big commitment in Finland too. Can you just talk about the Finnish market and the opportunity that you see there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Finnish market is quite similar to the Swedish market, and the Nordics markets are quite structured in the same way. What we see in Finland as of today is that the challenges of their transmission lines as well. I mean, they have wind usually in the northern part, and they have the loads mostly on the southern coastal cities. So they need flexibility into the grid today. And our approach to the Finnish market has been, I mean, it's been quite a plug and play market where we actually can use the same processes for connection. And I think also they have a very good TSO in Fingrid that is a pleasure of working with every time.
You don't hear that very often.
No, I don't think you do, but I must give them that actually. They're incredibly, you know, client oriented and good to work with, and really transparent as well. Well, what we're seeing in Finland as well is that the spreads in the market and the volatility in spot prices is, I think, one of the highest in Europe. I think, you know, when the disconnection from Russia also put them more into an island mode grid, or not fully an island mode grid, but they become more exposed to volatility in the market. And the introduction of a more base load in the nuclear site is also, you know, having quite big impacts on the market, where the top prices are quite high and the bottom prices are really low. So we see it as a very interesting market.
So we've talked about Sweden and we talked about Finland. Are you also looking at Norway?
We are looking at Norway. I mean, Norway is a very specific grid. It has some really interesting characteristics to it. Also, it has, I think 98% hydro, so it's a really hydro-based grid. But I believe that long term there will be grid scale BESS in Norway as well, and we'll be one of the parties that are building and operating it.
And to cover the last two then, are you also looking at Denmark and Iceland? What are your thoughts on those markets? Iceland obviously very small, but how about Denmark?
I mean, Denmark is divided in two. So for me, mainly, you know, the one part is Sweden and one part is Germany and the Danish market. So that hasn't been a focus, although I know that the DK2 is a super interesting market, but that size of itself is too small for us. And Iceland, we do want to have a battery market of at least 1 gigawatt to entry the market. That's kind of a guardrail that we work with. So that kind of excludes the smallest markets as of today.
So taking what you know about the Nordic countries as a whole, how does this region compare to other European markets? For example, if we think about grid need or market support or regulatory support, what are the key differences?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a big question, because I think that all markets usually have their specificities, and you need to work around that and you need to be smart about it. But I think, you know, having a hydro-based market, that is, of course, making you less, you will naturally have a lesser bit or less need of kind of a capacity market structure. You can solve most of those more residual load handling structures with the existing assets on the market. I do believe from a regulatory side, it's not been promoted that we, like in many markets, it's actually the TSO or the regulatory side that works actively with integrating BESS into the market and building different subsidy schemes or structure for that. We have not seen that in Sweden, but to be honest, I don't think we need it either. I think that the ancillary service markets has been good enough to cover the expansion in the Nordic markets, as for most, or for at least Finland and Sweden.
Let me ask you about the elephant in the room then, because one of the big problems is grid access at the moment in pretty much every market around the world. How do you get a connection to the grid in, if we just think about Sweden and Finland, where you're making big moves at the moment? How's the interconnection process? Is it really congested, and how's that being managed?
Grid is the main point for project development, if you look at it that way. So that's probably the thing we're spending most of our time thinking about. And I think here we have a really good value of being a fully integrated player with more. I mean, we do the trading, we do the optimization, we do the commercial structuring as well. And that gives us, you know, the feedback loop to understand the grid even more, because we know how we actually operate the systems in the grid. But to start with, I mean, we do quite intensive grid analytics in all countries we're active in. I mean, we do it in the Nordics, we do it in Germany, Poland, and try to look at, you know, how is topology of the grid formed? Where is the strong grid points? Where is the constraints? Where is the weaknesses? Where do you have existing infrastructure that can reduce capex on a connection, for example? I mean, I would say that probably 50% of your capacity in some way work with grid analytics and processes around that, because it is the key point when you develop projects. That has also been kind of a part of the success story, that we're really, you know, we are grid nerds, many of us, and I think it it's quite beneficial to try to understand, you know, both how the grid structure is working, but also the counterparties and the DSOs and the TSOs, you know, what's their problems, what's the situation and status of the of each grid you're trying to connect to.
So are there any specific problems that you only really find in Sweden or Finland with grid connections? Are there, I know that you guys are operating across Europe now, so any little bits of advice that you have for our listeners?
I mean, Sweden is an interesting point because we have the, you know, different sizes of DSOs. We have very many DSOs. It's quite similar as Germany for that aspect. But if you compare it to France or UK, it's something completely different because then the competence levels of the DSOs are usually in general very much higher because they have the mass to actually cover most of the points. So I think that is a really specific thing in Sweden that you need to work with the DSOs really close. You need to put a lot of effort into actually educating the DSOs on how your system is going to operate and how it will have implications of each specific grids. I mean, we see it in some other countries, but it's usually on the countries where you have a lot of DSOs compared to number of clients.
And how about Finland then?
Finland is probably more structured, and I think that's the main difference between Finland and Sweden, that most of the projects we're doing in Finland is towards DSOs with deeper knowledge of the questions, or it's directed towards the TSO, Fingrid. And it's, I mean, the availability and the speed to get the connection towards Fingrid is very, very much faster compared to Sweden.
So now I want to ask you about the structure of the company, because you mentioned earlier you've raised 250 million euros. And I know that the strategy for you is to be vertically integrated. So do you think of yourselves as a fund or as a distributed power plant? Or, you know, what's your thinking around that?
Yeah, I guess I would say that we think about ourselves as kind of the new type of energy company to come. I mean, flexibility is the problem that you need to solve in most European grids today. I strongly and do believe that you know, the future energy companies, even if it's utilities or IPPs or whatever it's going to be, it's going to look a lot more like Ingrid than compared to the legacy companies. And as a structure, I mean, what we do, we work with financial partners and investors to co-own assets together with, which is proven to be a really, you know, a good model for this to scale, because you have on one side, you have, you know, a really, I mean, we're kind of a tech company. We're doing a lot of, I'm not the expert on this, but we're doing a lot of tech development and software development and that parts of the company. And then you have a really CapEx heavy infrastructure. So we try to, you know, from an ownership perspective, try to separate this. But of course, with the caveats that we want to operate the assets of question, and we do believe that we want to co-own them as much as possible, because we think that, you know, the value of having this kind of synergies that you only get by actually being able to operate your own assets is so high. So, and I think it's very beneficial for the investors as well. So it's served us well.
Well, I was going to ask you about that technology side. So I understand that Ingrid has decided to build their own trading platform. I mean, the first thing is that Nordic countries historically are excellent at building trading companies and power market companies. So it doesn't surprise me that you've decided to do it in-house, but you've decided to build your own proprietary trading platform as well as developing and operating assets. And that must be a big challenge and a big decision. What drove that decision?
Yeah, it was a big decision, but I think it came out of the you know, realization that we didn't believe that the market as the status when we took the decision had any good enough alternatives. So it was mainly out of need that we saw that we need to develop this ourselves, because we didn't see the market maturity wasn't there, and transparency that we needed wasn't either available on the market. So that was probably the driver of the decision from the beginning. And then, I mean, I must say that I was a bit surprised on the performance of the platform as well. So I think, you know, from that side, it's been a really good decision. But it's only, I mean, it's one part commercially, but it's also, I mean, we see the benefits in our development process, or when we do when we look at commercial structures or KPI structuring or stuff like that, and then we also see the value of having actual real data on the assets that we're taking out to the market. So it has many, you know, upsides that I must admit I didn't see in the beginning, but I clearly see it now.
And how does that work in practice then? If you're building hundreds of millions of euros of assets and you do the market access and trading yourselves, how do you think about structuring the projects commercially? Because we're moving from contracts to revenues or ancillary services into a merchant model. A lot of asset owners are considering more flexible or more structure in their PPAs. So how do you think about applying the kind of risk management parts of merchant versus contracted versus hybrid when you do all of it in-house?
I think we will do the things that if we feel that we can compete with the market and are hopefully better than the market on the parts, then we will do it ourselves. But if we see that there are, you know, off-the-shelf solutions for it, then we probably will go out to the market also to find this, to be smart from an IRR, you know, weighted IRR perspective, I think is the key here. And then our assets as of today, we've built fully merchant, but we're always looking out for opportunity to contract parts of it. I think that, you know, it's a moving target, but probably you would long term, we will probably see a contracted part of, you know, 30 to 50% on our assets total. I think that's usually where you get the bankability you need. But it's changing constantly. But we won't be able to build 8 gigawatts on fully merchant. We're very aware of that.
So talking about contracted capacity, I understand that in Sweden, we don't yet have a robust capacity market or equivalent. So how do you think about the role of other revenue sources, so balancing services, ancillary markets, wholesale trading, as core parts of your revenue strategy?
The Swedish system usually solved the residual load issues with the strategic reserve. But it's quite a cost-effective way of solving it. I don't see the capacity market long-term in Sweden either. But what I do see and what that opens up for us is kind of because there will be players on the market that has a need for securing capacity for some hours, for example. So there will probably be a more bilateral market for that, where you see buy or trilateral contracted revenue structures towards assets owners or loads. And I mean, it's also been one of the reasons why we're building up kind of a markets function in the company, that we see that the probability of having a capacity market in Sweden is quite low, but the fundamental need of you know, structuring capture rates and structuring PPAs towards more, maybe not 24/7 PPAs, but at least 7/11 PPAs, that's really important. So it takes, you know, you need people that has the experience of structuring these kind of products to be able to do it.
And just rewinding for a second, coming back to at the beginning of the conversation, we talked about batteries and hydropower, and I mentioned maybe they would come up against each other or compete, and you framed it quite nicely that the batteries will complement hydropower. Where do you see this heading? So we've talked about CapEx coming down for batteries, and it seems like the cost curves, there doesn't seem to be a clear end in sight for how low the price of cells can go. So if you fast forward now to Ingrid in 10 years' time, what do you think the Nordic power markets look like? Because they're so heavily dominated by hydro right now. And there's quite a lot of discussion at the moment about extending life extensions on hydro or expanding reservoirs or even some new hydro. How do you think about batteries and hydro working together or competing in a world where CapEx has come down for another 10 years?
I think it's going to be, you know, one of the key factors for a really cost-efficient grid in the future. For the grids that has the opportunity to actually combine in a smart way hydro and batteries. Because, I mean, yeah, prices will go down on batteries, but we're pretty much on a level now where the cell part of the battery of the best cost is reducing all the time. So now the biggest cost posts in the future might probably be, you know, more the power components and the inverters, for example. And I don't see the price development as much on that kind of component. So there will be a diminishing return on CapEx kind of reductions on BESS as well. But back to your question, I think that yes, batteries would probably be the major technology to deal with all the short to mid-term volatility, and also, you know, every kind of service to make sure that the grid runs stable and as it should. And then hydro will be there to cover, you know, now, I mean, we're heavily influenced by the German market as well. And I think that the Swedish hydro can probably do a lot of help on the Dunkelflaute and the situation where you actually don't have enough production. So Ingrid Capacity and myself as well is looking at this as, you know, we need to solve the European grid problem. This is not a Nordic problem. It's not a UK problem. It's actually making sure that we as a European Union and as a European region will be able to have the industry of the future as well. And for that, we need, you know, cost-efficient grid infrastructure and low prices on electricity.
Yeah, I think it's going to be fascinating to see how hydro generation competes with renewables long-term. Of course, hydro is part of renewables. I must say that there's a Venn diagram somewhere with that within it. But I mean, versus, you know, Swedish wind or Swedish solar, or European solar and wind, we shall see. But there's one of the cool things about hydro in the Nordics is how beautiful those generating plants are. And so I hope that they continue for a long, long time. Okay, so thinking more about the future then and where Ingrid is heading, we talked about your North Star being 8 gigawatts of batteries on the grid by the end of this decade, which is a hell of a job to get done. How is the mission evolving as you head towards that? What do you need to do to make that happen? You're at 65 people today, you've raised 250 million euros. What's the scale that you need to achieve to deliver that mission?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think that we will continue to grow, and we will continue to enter countries, and we need to do it fast. We need to do it with an M&A approach in many markets as well. I think being able to operate that amount of gigawatts, it will take, you know, a lot of work with the bankability of projects, the bankability of the portfolio structures, and it will need a lot of CapEx funding, to be honest, as well. So from our perspective, making sure that we really reap the benefits of being a fully integrated player, I think that's a key part. I think, you know, making sure that we have the tools and understanding to make projects in scale bankable in all markets, super important as well. But, you know, last but not least, probably is, you know, we also need as a company to be super agile with the market movements, because what we've seen, you know, is best markets move fast. They move extremely fast. I mean, you can take the just recent example from the Polish capacity market, for example, where the next round was quite not as compelling for batteries as some might thought it would be. So, and that of course...
What do you mean by that, Niklas? Just for our listeners, can you share what you mean by that?
I mean, they reduced the rating factor for BESS quite a lot in the next round. And of course, that has implications on the business cases. And I mean, for us, it was, I mean, we pretty much maybe saw it coming, not in the size that it actually went, but I mean, there was warning signs. But the importance as a company for us, I mean, that you need to be one, you need to understand the markets and be smart about what is actually going on, and not only, you know, what are people saying, but also, you know, being able to act fast on changes. We see it, you know, everything from whenever a new market open up in, let's say, Sweden or Finland or anything like that, towards, you know, the big swings in either capacity market. There will always be a political risk in capacity markets, because it's not a fundamentally needed structure. It's one structure that you can use, but you can use it. You can solve the issue in many ways. Ancillary service you can't solve in that many other ways. I mean, you probably need a disturbance reserve, and you need a normal reserve, and you need a kind of a forecasting error reserve, and then you can call it whatever you want. But that's the fundamental needs for grids. And we as a company, I think that's one of maybe the key benefits we have towards bigger utilities, that we can be super agile, we can be super fast, and we can adapt really, really fast. And I think that to reach our goal is going to be a major key as well. And then lastly, maybe also making sure that we use all all new kind of digital tools that are being developed and are active now. I mean, I'm starting to feel old now when you know, you can use helpful tools to actually increase the you know, the output of your own work quite drastically. And it's I'm humbled to the fact that there is apparently ways to optimize my own work and others' work. So that is, of course, going to be a key for the future as well.
Yeah, you could do a lot more with less these days.
I think our software team would probably be four times as big without, like, it's probably not ChatGPT, but you know, the coding version. Is it Cursor, maybe? I don't know.
There's not really much space for us humans left in the medium to long term. Now to the last two questions. Is there anything that you want to plug for our listeners who tend to be energy storage people based in Europe, Australia, and the US?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm probably preaching for the choir, but I think, I mean, flexibility is key for optimized grids. I think, you know, we all know it, but I mean, it's so cool to see it become reality. And it's so cool to see, you know, the grids. If you look at live data on how grids are actually operating today, there is big difference compared to just 5 years ago. And it's kind of, you know, the scale of difference that at least I didn't think was possible. So I think that's, and I think it's going to be the key for optimized grids of the future. And then you can combine it with everything. You can have demand response. You can have a bit of, you know, gas peakers or heating plants or whatever it be. But you need not only planability, you need controllability of the production and loads.
It's great you describe it as really cool. And I totally agree with you. And now your contrarian view. So Nicholas, what do you believe that not a lot of other people believe?
It's a really good question. I think, I mean, maybe I'm not, you know, it's not only me, but I truly don't believe that Europe can compete if we do a lot of nuclear into the grids. I don't believe we will never be most cost efficient of building nuclear in the European Union. Unfortunately, I think it's a good way to reduce the competitiveness of the European grid, I think, today. I mean, might not be as contrarian. I think your listeners and viewers probably agree a bit more than the general public. But I do believe that I'm not against nuclear as such, but I'm against stupid financing structures. And that's where we're aiming for in many European countries right now. And it kind of scares me.
Yeah, who couldn't be pro cheap nuclear? But
yeah, exactly.
We just haven't managed to make it work in the Western world.
I don't know what we're doing wrong, but something. I mean, we apparently can't do it fast or cheap. So maybe we should think about that.
I wonder whether I'm going to get into trouble for saying this, but I think the root cause of the problem is bureaucracy, and the root cause of that is fear mongering on the safety side. I think there's just far too much worst case scenario planning. I know that listeners will say, yes, but what about Fukushima and Chernobyl and all of these? And yes, they are terrible, but I did a brief stint in nuclear at the start of my career, and I couldn't believe how difficult it was to get anything done. I don't know how you roll that back. You've got all of the expertise in nuclear is also entwined with a over-indexing on the safety case, some of which is totally valid and the right thing to do. You know, getting fired for not holding the handrail as you walk down the stairs probably doesn't count. That's not a nuclear incident, right? Parking the wrong way around in a parking bay is not a nuclear incident because it's on a nuclear site. And these are ridiculous examples, but if you extrapolate them, they're everywhere. Same with security and access to documents and people, you know, all of it. But I do think if we could solve that, then I would have a totally different opinion. If you could bring the real cost of nuclear down to kind of less than, let's say, 50 cents, 40 cents, then maybe you'd consider it.
Yeah, yeah.
And even that is expensive, right? Even that is expensive. Yeah.
No, but I mean, you will need baseload. I strongly believe that. But you will need to solve, I mean, you can solve baseload in many ways. But I do believe that I'm more against, you know, whenever it's structured similar to kind of a cost plus model is introduced for this kind of infrastructure, then I think, yeah, that's the best way of keeping stuff expensive. And no one will never do efficiency on that kind of structure. So I think that that's maybe UK has had a kind of a value-based structure for it, although it seems to be getting a bit expensive. But
you can say that again. Nicholas is the most expensive object on the planet, and nobody's making money from it, right? Okay, apart from I'm starting to sound like an old man in the pub here, but you know, EDF's not happy about it. The taxpayers not happy about it. The government's not. The power sector's not happy about it. The question is, what do you do when you lose all of that nuclear-based load in the UK that is going to disappear probably this decade? You guys are lucky; you've got loads of hydro. We don't have that luxury.
No, and I mean, we need to solve the baseload problem. That's a fact. And the misconception about nuclear as of today is that it's cheap and scary, or cheap and unsafe. But it's probably just, I mean, right now it's expensive and quite safe, but that's, I mean, we need to be innovative. We can't just replicate what we did in the 1970s. That will take us nowhere. We need to use, you know, whatever kind of new development that has been going on the last 50 years. I think it's quite much. So, and use that to do stuff more efficient. And even if it's nuclear, I think, you know, this is not my field, but I strongly believe that if you get kind of structures where the feeling is that kind of a monopoly or oligopoly players has set the rules for the future oligopoly, that will not be cost efficient. But they got no incentives to do that. It's crazy.
So how do you solve the baseload problem in Europe then? Because many countries in Europe are pivoting to nuclear, and there's this exciting unicorn of small modular reactors, which we probably won't touch right now, but some hope there, but also quite a lot of noise. So in that case, how do you solve the baseload problem in Europe while we're on it?
I mean, one is probably the way it's done now with the very expensive nuclear structures that are being presented. Then it's about just managing the damage and reduce. I mean, how little baseload do you actually need? That's the kind of question we need to ask, because right now if we're coming to low levels of baseload, which, you know, where that kind of prices actually has an impact on the system, then there won't be any clients for the electricity. That's the basics. I mean, no one's going to buy that. So say, and the industry will move to other regions with cheaper electricity. So it's, then we be producing a lot of electrons, or not producing electrons, but yeah, I don't want to, you know, mess with my former electrical engineers. I think it's thinking about how little actual baseload do you need? How can you structure baseload in other ways? I mean, wind, solar and batteries is kind of a, you know, compelling baseload structure as of now. It won't solve it all, but I think it can reduce the cost and the needs for baseload quite drastically. And I think it's a good point to start.
Yeah, it's like whichever way you look at it, Europe's going to have to pivot to China, I think, because the entire supply chain, in order for industry to be, so this is the funny thing, for Europe to compete with China on industry, they need to bring electricity costs down. In order to bring the electricity costs down, they need to buy generation from the cheapest supply chains, which is China. So whatever you do, we need to, Europe needs to cozy up to China, I think.
Yeah.
It's quite an uncomfortable thing to say out loud, but maybe it's not such a bad thing.
Well, I hope we can avoid it, but who knows?
All right. And on that note, Nicholas, I want to say a massive thank you for joining us on the podcast. That was awesome. If you haven't heard about Ingrid Capacity, we're going to put some links in the show notes. This is a company to watch. And I know a lot of our listeners with operations in Europe are thinking about the Nordics. Go check these guys out. They've moved so quickly, and they've got a really compelling story. So Nicholas, thanks for joining us on the podcast. Really enjoyed this one.
Thank you so much for having us, and a pleasure. Good discussion. I really enjoyed it.